with four moons and stripes and this giant hurricane, and a whole lot of four-letter words came out of my mouth, which is normal for me. But, you know, I was just like, holy beep, you know, like, I've never seen anything like this. And I was just blown away that there were these other worlds.
That was Dr. H. Howells on this week's episode of the People of Veterinary Medicine podcast. The People of Veterinary Medicine, powered by Luca Veterinary Data Security. In this week's episode, we are talking with Dr. H. Howells. And if the veterinary community wasn't small enough, when you start to look at the community within your own four walls, at least we have four walls in Colorado because we're a pretty square-shaped state, but the community gets even smaller. And so it seemed like her name kept getting brought up in so many different circles that I'm a part of. And so it was great to really be able to sit down and actually talk with her and get to learn more about her. As you will hear from her story, what I love about her story so much is that she has done a lot of different things, from being an adjunct professor in physics to playing music in Mexico to now being becoming a DVM and now running her Agents of Change coaching business, as well as working for the CVMA and doing a euthanasia service. I mean, she has done it all. And I am one of those people that I am just a sucker for change, and I love to do new things, and I love to try new things. And so when I meet people that are doing new things or have tried a lot of things, I love to hear their story just because it really resonates with me, and I can really, I just really gravitate towards it. And I just love to learn more about what pushed them to try new and exciting things. And I just see so many parallels in my life and theirs. And so I really enjoyed getting to know H and having this conversation with her. And one thing that we talked about a little bit, and that she's working with Agents of Change, her coaching business, is that being a veterinarian doesn't necessarily have to be your calling. And so if you're one of those people out there where vet med wasn't necessarily your calling when you were a kid, that's okay. And how do you kind of then realize that this is something you're really good at, something you're doing, but it's maybe not necessarily your calling in life, which I think is a really interesting conversation. And also something that really resonates with me. I guess if you would have asked me, you know, when I was in high school or if I was a younger kid, hey, what are you going to be when you grow up? If I would have said, hey, I'm going to be owning a cybersecurity and data protection company in the veterinary space, no, that wasn't going to happen. So I could have never imagined where I ended up. And you never know where life will take you. So with that being said, sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode. But first, this episode is brought to you by Luca Veterinary Data Security, where our mission is to help veterinary practice owners everywhere realize the value of their data and help them take the necessary steps to protect it. So if you need help protect data in your practice, the first thing you can do is go to luca.vet and download our 5 Simple Steps to Protect Your Practice ebook, which is free. So again, go to www.luca.vet and look for our 5 Simple Steps to Start Protecting Your Practice.
Two. What's the two?
The two is just all you need is love.
Okay.
And what's seven is? Tell me seven again.
Seven is like the optimist, right? Seven is the
gratitude and optimism. Yeah, and moving forward.
Yeah, and I don't ever want like FOMO, right? Fear of missing out.
Yes, I gotta jump. I gotta leap. I can't hold still. Yeah. You don't hold still well.
No. Not at all. So what's really ironic about the Enneagram is when my friend first told me about it, I was kind of, how would you say, I was like skeptical, right?
Yeah.
So I went to the Enneagram Institute's website because, you know, there's all these like, well, you know, there's a bunch of free ones, but they're like, you know, I read a couple books and people are like, well, go to the actual Enneagram Institute and that one's probably going to be the most accurate. So I took it. I paid my $15 or whatever. And then as I was like, so it came out with seven, and so I started reading it and I was like, I feel like this I feel like this is explaining my life and like my personality. Because I'm always such a sucker for change. You know, I love to change. I love to grow. I love to do stuff. And
are you recording it?
What's that?
Push record.
Oh, yeah. I recorded a while ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'll edit a lot of the front stuff out, but just so I can make sure that the beginning's good. But anyways, so yeah. Yeah, so looking at the seven, I was just like, yeah, it all made sense. I'm a sucker for change. I do always have this fear of missing out, you know, like, oh, but if I really dedicate 100% to this, then maybe I'm going to miss out on something else, you know? So this idea of the fear of missing out is, I think, it totally explains me. It works. So I guess to circle that back, this whole idea of starting this new company and all the other things that go into that, it's been the, you know, I want $1 million a month in revenue yesterday, not today. And, you know, all these lofty goals and stuff you set for yourself, it's like, I wanted it done yesterday, not today, you know, not tomorrow, not 6 months from now. So the impatience of it, right?
It's a double-edged sword, because it means you get a lot of stuff done, but makes it hard to take a break. It makes it really frustrating.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. So tell me about the two.
So, it's really simple. The two is just really focused on meaningful connection with people.
Oh.
And love and empathy. And the two puts out a lot of love, like the freaking Care Bear stare kind of thing. And if it's not returned, they get really butthurt about it. As far as I can tell, yeah. That's the essence of the two.
Yeah. That's all. So, okay, so on that, you talk about this idea of care, and that's kind of like the core of your personality. Was that a driving factor for you getting into vet med?
It was really a driving factor getting out.
Really? Okay. That's actually that's an interesting response.
Yeah. I'll say something really offensive about getting into vet med.
That's okay.
Which is that I had this idea that I wanted to do it as a kid, but I was never one of the people for whom veterinary medicine was a calling. It's the only thing I can envision myself doing. I'm going to bust my own nutsack to get it done no matter what happens, at the expense of my relationships, at the expense of being a teenager, whatever, all that kind of stuff. I was never one of those people, and I admire the drive and the focus of those people, but I wasn't. I talked to the veterinarian in my town, because I'm from this really little town, so there was one veterinarian. Actually, they were two. They were a married couple. And they were like, oh, don't do it. You'll have no quality of life, and you'll be on call all the time. And I was like, okay, you're right. I don't want to do that. And I forgot about it for 20 years. So I went off and I did other things. Went to college the first time around. Majored in physics. Loved astronomy, decided I was not into the idea of a PhD, so I moved to Arizona to teach as an undergrad TA full-time for a university. My job evaporated, I ran away with a boyfriend to Mexico, left him to play in a band, and that's kind of what happened in my 20s. And so when I was in undergrad, I was working 3 or 4 jobs all the time just to try to make ends meet, and I felt really burned out getting out of undergrad. And so I finally was living in Mexico, playing guitar in bars, sitting on a rock in the sunshine one day, and said, you know, I think that I am recovered enough from undergrad that I could go to school again, but I don't know what I would do. Maybe I'll go back to this idea of being a veterinarian. And so I never want to sound offensive to the people for whom this was the be-all, end-all of their entire life. But in some ways, it was a fallback. It was a, maybe I shouldn't get to be 50 years old and have done nothing with my life other than play guitar in bars, which was a huge mistake. I should have stayed and played guitar in bars for the rest of my life. But I came back to the little beach town I grew up in, and I had to do my prerequisites over again. It had been a while. I never took all those, like, core classes. So I did all of that and went to vet school. And so it kind of was just, I don't know what else to do, so I'm going to go do this. Getting out of vet med is a different story entirely. because I got in to vet med. I thought I was going to be a food animal veterinarian. I love getting beat up outside. I love the population medicine. Cows are amazing. And then I married a city guy, so I ended up coming to Denver and practicing small animal. And it's very different. It's a very different proposition. If you've read the Merck Veterinary Wellbeing Study, they cite food animal veterinarians as being the group that actually has the highest quality of life and the best mental health profile if you average that across all individuals. And so I went from this world where I was going to be working out and getting beat up outdoors to being in a small animal clinic where not only was there a lot of pressure, but these are people's babies. That's huge. That was a little bit crushing. My husband was out of work for the first while after we moved to Colorado. It just was the height of the recession. One in five households had one adult out of work. We were just part of that 20%. And, you know, that took a while. So I burned out a little bit there, picking up every relief shift I could. And by about 4 years into practicing small animal medicine, I was done, because on top of all that, I realized I was really trapped by my student loans. As you've kind of heard, I had this bounce around gypsy kind of existence where every time I got bored of the last thing I was doing, I just looked at the next help wanted sign I saw and thought to myself, oh, I could go do that. But I looked around and I was like, I'm miserable. I can't get out because I owe the government more than $200,000. There's nothing that I can do. I'm trapped. And I became really angry. And it was kind of the rock bottom of my veterinary career. And so all I could think about for like a year and a half was how in the world I was going to get the hell out of veterinary medicine. We had serious talks about me going back to waiting tables and fine dining. As depressing a statistic as this is, and it's just a statistic about me, but I made about as much per hour waiting tables and fine dining as I did as a doctor. Except now I had $210,000 of student loans to go with it. So that was a little depressing, but I had more fun waiting tables. It was great. I'm extroverted. It was fun. I was done at the end of the day. I walked away. I didn't lose sleep over whether somebody didn't like their meal. The way that I lost sleep over watching one of my clients lose a relationship that for them was like their child. It's a totally different ball of wax. But I felt trapped and I couldn't go. And at that time, I was involved in the Power of 10 through the Colorado Veterinary Medical Association. Every year they take 10 veterinarians from the state of Colorado who are on the early side of their career, and they put them through a year's worth of professional development, leadership training, communication training. And I hit my rock bottom during that year, and I saw other classmates going through the same thing. But in the end, I began to resuscitate myself from that dark spot a little bit by giving back. So I got signed up through the Power of 10 to run a support group for veterinarians. And I learned that there were people that were in a much darker place than me, even within our profession. I did that for 4 years. I went back to coach the Power of 10, and I saw that not only had I been suffering, but I was surrounded by really good people who were suffering a lot. And that's the care that lit my heart on fire and made me want to do something. So that's why I'm
the two.
Getting out. Yeah.
The two, yeah.
The Care Bear stare. Yeah. Right?
No, I mean, man, you said so many powerful things there that I would love for you to touch on. So I think what is interesting is you talk about this struggle of, okay, so waiting tables, you give somebody a meal, their steak's bad, whatever. You can fix it, not a big deal, right? I can walk away from that.
We used to joke about him behind the back and to say, you know, if that's the worst thing that happened to you all week, wonderful.
Right? Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. And then you talk about this struggle of losing, especially now, me personally, I'm in that boat. Just lost was the first time. I've lost dogs growing up as a child. But in February is the first time I had to personally make that decision to say,
this is it.
This is it, right? yeah, that it sucks. There's no, ironically, I was just thinking about it as I was like driving down here. And I was kind of going through in my mind what that process was like and how, I don't even know why I'm going on this tangent, but yeah, the start of the cancer battle and that whole unknown to the end. And I thought it would be easier because it was like a 2-year battle. And so we kind of had time to prepare. And, but you were right. I mean, it's tough. But what I find fascinating about that is now you are kind of focusing on that end of life.
In one of my scopes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So right now I have two ventures going on. So to kind of finish from the story before, in 2018, I launched Agents of Change Coaching. And so that's my coaching business where I work with veterinarians or veterinary teams or just lay individuals or whoever, and I do health, life, and team coaching to try to help people live in alignment with their values and get back to a place where they embody their own vision of health and thriving. I do also right now also have an at-home euthanasia service called Peace Wings. And I think that I want to clarify something that's kind of coming out of what I said before. While it's true that it is stressful to have the pressure of knowing that you're treating somebody's kid, I feel that's one thing in a day-to-day clinic existence where you're expected to fix everything, and you know that some of that is out of your control as a doctor, and you know that it might not be the outcome that you want, and you know that it might not be the outcome that they want. I think by the time somebody, at least for me, has gone ahead and made that euthanasia decision or is starting to circle around to think about that, they enter much more of a place of gratitude. And you can tell me if this resonates with your experience at all. But I would always tell people that gratitude is my number one core value. And when I go to somebody's home to help them say goodbye in their home setting, in a place where their pet is really comfortable and they've built all these memories, the stress is gone because those people are sitting in a moment where they realize the treasure that they have in their pet while their pet is still in front of them. And that's uplifting. That's a gift. So I would say that the pressure of being in the clinic and being expected to fix everything and having all those expectations all the time, some of which are reasonable and some of which are not, is a very different. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I don't know if a lot of people, I'm probably not the only one, but sometimes I think I'm the only one. As I look back at like the end of Cash's life and I look back on everything, like there's so many regrets, right? Like you think about the times I got mad or frustrated because he had TCC, so transitional cellular carcinoma in his bladder and his prostate. So he couldn't control his bladder as well. He had all sorts of problems. And, you know, those moments when you're so tired of cleaning up the mess and you're so tired of this and you get frustrated. And it was like in the moment that he was leaving, like just incredible guilt for those moments, right? Like, you're like at that time you're like, oh, it's stupid. Like why, you know, it gives you a new lens to look through, right?
Yeah.
On that, one of the things I look back at is that in some regards, I feel that the vet that we worked with to put Cash down had it easier in some respects, because I think for most vets, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like most vets, when a patient walks in a pet parent, I should say, walks in the room, generally there's all these things that you're like, well, we could do all these things, but there's this money conversation that comes up and the expense of veterinary medicine. And sometimes there's this idea that maybe we're not, you know, we don't want to come off as selling, but we know that, hey, to do the best care of medicine, there's a bunch of things we can do, but it's going to cost a decent amount of money. So in that, like when I walked in, I was like, I knew it was his kidneys. I just knew right away. And I think it's because, again, I'm surrounded by insanely smart people in the industry. And so I was kind of set up for what was kind of be the charge. And I was like, well, we need to run his blood work. And I'm pretty sure it's his kidneys. And so she's like, okay, cool. Let me go do that. So she comes back and yeah, like his BUN and his creatinine levels were off the charts. They weren't even readable. And what's the, I was just doing a webinar the other day and I brought this up as an example. And I can't remember. IDEX has that lab now that is specific to kidney values.
SDMA.
Yeah, SDMA. Yeah, yeah. That one was like way off the charts.
Yeah.
And so I knew, right? So I was like, okay, there's nothing, like, there's no coming back from this. His kidneys have shut down. So it was super easy. However, when I, like, because we have another Yorkie, so we had two, we have one, he's 15 now, and I think I totally would do it different in that at that moment, I would have left and then called a service like yours. Mm. And the reason I say that is because Cash spent so much time in the tech area, you know,
right,
like getting the IV prepped, and he's already sick. We know, I mean, thank God for organizations like Fear Free and all these other organizations,
right,
but still, even as hard as, like, it's a place he knows he gets poked and prodded and it's terrible, right? And so then I felt really bad about that. And then it was just, and then also it was, we're sitting in the waiting room or in the exam room, and it's like, these are the last minutes of his life, but yet, you know, you were separated, right? So as I look at that, I definitely would do that again. So that was...
You know, it strikes me a lot, and I don't want to interrupt you talking about your experience, but I still go and do relief shifts in a variety of veterinary hospitals, and I only go to ones that I like working at, where I'm happy to be there and I'm happy to see the pets, and I get to make that choice now that I'm doing relief. And I'll tell you that it is so different for pets. And I think when you're in a veterinary clinic as a veterinarian or a technician day in and day out, and you're like, oh, everybody's barking all the time. Everybody's rushing around all the time. That becomes your normal. And you can do fear-free, and you can have a wonderful waiting room and a streamlined customer service, get in, get to the exam room so your pet's not stressed in the lobby process, and you can have squeezed cheese and peanut butter and all these things, and you can be totally pumped to see those dogs and cats, and they're still just going to be more tense in an environment that's outside their normal than they ever are going to be at home. And it wasn't until I started going into people's homes that I began to appreciate that. I think that what you're saying is that you're coming at it from the perspective of a pet parent who says, you're right, I don't want those last few moments with my treasured baby to be in a clinical environment. It's no offense against veterinary clinics.
No, not
it's
at
just
all, yeah.
Not ideal. But Dr. Mary Gardner, who you referenced earlier, I recently heard her talk about a statistic that I think she said a lot of pet parents may not go back to the same veterinary clinic where their pet was euthanized. So I think there's also a win-win proposition here, because if general practitioners say to those pet parents or those pet owners, you might have a better experience for yourself, your pet might have a better experience if you do this at home, they might actually be bonding that client to their own practice even more. So I think it's kind of a win-win-win to have that become more widespread.
Yeah. And in a lot of respects, I'm insanely fortunate because I have eyes behind the scenes, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I have the eyes to be able to see all the different options that are available and what this looks like. And, yeah, again, I'm making this podcast way about me, and it's not about me, but yeah, I mean, I could go on, but yeah, so we'll shift conversations, but I do think it's a really interesting and fascinating conversation to have, because anybody that's out there that has pets that are listening, they're going to have to go through it at some point, and we all sign up for it, right?
Yeah.
But anyways, one other thing that you were kind of talking about is that also kind of rang with me was this idea that you're really into astronomy and physics, which has been something I've been insanely fascinated with as a kid. So much so that, like, when I was in, like, third grade, like, we got a color printer. My mom was super pissed because I wasted all the ink.
printing out Hubble images.
Yeah, exactly. I'd printed out the images of each planet, and I'd, like, taped them around my room, you know, in sequential order, and it just, like, burned through, like, $40 worth of ink. So, yeah, well, how did that start, and then how did you... And you got this job, and then you said that job just dissolved?
It's a crazy story. So I went to college. I didn't know what I was going to do. I took a survey astronomy course on a whim, and I looked through the telescope for the first time. And this was in Providence, Rhode Island. So it was a lot of cloudy nights, but we had a clear night and this 2-foot telescope. And everybody in front of me in class was climbing up the ladder. You were supposed to draw what you saw in your lab notebook and get down and let the next person. And everybody was just like, huh. They'd climb up the ladder. They'd look through. They'd go, huh. And then they'd draw something and get down. And I climbed up the ladder and I looked through the telescope. And there was Jupiter with 4 moons and stripes and this giant hurricane. And a whole lot of 4-letter words came out of my mouth, which is normal for me. But, you know, I was just like, holy beep, you know, like, I've never seen anything like this. And I was just blown away that there were these other worlds. So I ended up majoring in that. As I got through undergrad, I realized that you really needed a PhD to do anything with it. And I also had an internship during my junior year in Arizona at the National Optical Astronomy Observatories. And I witnessed a lot of people being really stressed out. And I thought, their spouses don't know what they look like. Their dogs don't know what they look like. They are all fighting for funding all the time. And instead of being out there really observing and answering these questions, they are lucky to get 2 nights of data a year. And then they spend the next 8 months in the basement analyzing it in this total introvert existence. And every time I've tried to shoehorn myself into a career that's well suited for introverts, when I'm a flaming extrovert, I flame out. I took one look at that and I said, I don't think I can go get a PhD. But I also took a semester abroad within the United States. Columbia University used to run this thing called the Universe Semester. It was held on the Biosphere campus in Arizona because much of the astronomy in the United States happens in Arizona. High mountains, clear atmosphere, not a lot of humidity. And so I went and did a semester there, and I went back as a full-time TA for undergrads in that program after I graduated. And then my job evaporated because Columbia pulled out of that project. And it went away. Things happen.
Then you talk about this idea of this band, and also something I can totally resonate with. I mean, sure, some people know this about me. I think I may have talked about it with Dr. Cindy Trice, but I was in a rock band, and we played the Vans Warped Tour, and yeah.
Awesome. It was,
yeah, and so, you know, and we went on tour, and our van blew up heading outside of Vegas on I-15, and we had to push it back. I mean, take the Greyhound home.
All the adventures.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you go from essentially kind of like a physics professor of some degree to now playing music in bars?
Well, I had always really been into music. I doodled around on the guitar for years, but I had studied like vocal music really seriously. I'd done piano for 8 or 10 years or something, and I sang pretty seriously in college as well. It just wasn't my major. And so when the job at the Biosphere evaporated, my college boyfriend had followed me from Rhode Island to Arizona, and he said, well, I followed you. Now it's your turn to follow me. I want to go live in southern Mexico. So I was like, that sounds fun.
Like the country Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Southern Mexico. Oaxaca.
Okay.
Specifically.
Yeah.
And so we moved to Oaxaca. We saved up enough money to live down there for a year without making any. We moved to Oaxaca, and This is the second time that I tried to shoehorn myself into something that was way too introverted for me. I thought I was going to try to write a novel, as crazy as that sounds. So I had bought this used laptop computer with a fan that was broken that went every time I turned it on. But it was what I could afford. And so I took that down there, and I just realized that I could not make myself sit in a coffee shop and write for 8 hours a day, which is what you need to do if you're going to write a novel. So I was down there trying to write a book, failing miserably. I thought, this is the guitar mecca of the world. I'm in Oaxaca, Mexico. I'm going to take some guitar lessons. And I bought a cheap guitar, walked into the lesson. After the third lesson, the guy teaching me was like, why don't you stop paying for lessons and come play with our band? And I was like, yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah.
I'm there. So that's how that happened.
And so you... Was it Spanish, like Spanish music?
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
So Mexican traditional music, huapangos, rancheros, boleros.
Wow.
Corridos.
Yeah. And so what was that? I mean, what was it? Hey, what was it like being an American living in southern Mexico, playing in this traditional Mexican band?
It was the adventure of a lifetime. It was so wonderful.
Yeah. So how does that chapter end?
I sat on a rock, was like, maybe I should do something else with my life besides play guitars and bars, and went back to the beach town where I grew up in and started taking veterinary school prerequisites. It was kind of a national identity crisis. I didn't know which way to go.
Yeah.
I sometimes think I should have stayed down there.
Yeah.
But
why?
Why? That's a really great question. Because it was one of the happiest times of my life. I think when you move to another country or to a place that's really different from where you grew up, all of a sudden you see yourself in contrast with your surroundings. When I'm in surroundings that are very familiar to me, I kind of blend in even to myself. When I moved to Oaxaca, I was learning a new language. I was in a new culture. I made incredible friends. I had this crazy group of friends that we went gallivanting all over the place all night long after our gigs, and we called ourselves the Drunk Poets Society, La Sociedad de Poetas Ebrios. We had a great time. It was this crazy bohemian existence, but it was also so different than the United States in so many ways. I think a lot of people think of Mexico as the border region, and I don't think the border region is a flattering view of either of our countries, personally. But where I lived in Oaxaca, you know, I also had a lot of friends who were teachers. I had it was opposite to our culture in so many ways. They didn't necessarily have off on holidays, but you felt it more when you were off from work. There was this better divide of, okay, now we're working. Okay, now we're playing. Okay, now we're just walking through the market, eating popcorn, having a smoothie, whatever it was. Mm. It was so much more relaxed and understanding and non-judgmental and compassionate. There was a huge separation between everyday life and people and the powers that were in the background pulling strings. It was a good place for me. A good place.
Have you
for
been
me.
Back?
Not the way I would like to.
Yeah.
Not the way I would like to. I went and did an external rotation when I was in vet school on the food animal portion of the UNAM campus in Querétaro. I've gone back on a couple of veterinary volunteer projects, but I haven't gone back just traveling. And I hope to do that with my kids someday. I would also love to expatriate myself if I ever get to retire.
You know, ironically, I have a friend of ours. She's super fascinating because she's Japanese, and then she moved to the States. She married an American guy, but he like speaks really good Japanese, which is also kind of crazy. But anyways, so they ended up just like deciding, yeah, we're going to move down to Mexico. And they moved down to, so there's Cabo that's on the peninsula, and then there's the town that's like across on the mainland.
I'd have
I can't
to
remember.
Look
I'm drawing a blank. But anyways, yeah, they moved down there, and it seems like she's having a great time, and she's really enjoying it. And ironically, she's also in. She's a dog trainer, which is also kind of ironic. Like she's also an animal, so it's kind of yeah. My life is a little bit interesting, but yes. So one thing I would. Okay, let me tell this story, and I think this is why. There's two pieces to this story. The first one is that as somebody who doesn't consume animal products. I find it very fascinating that there are not more people in the veterinary space who are also vegetarian or more plant-based. And this is not to me, this is not like some sort of vegan propaganda on the podcast. And I honestly don't care how other people eat. I eat it way for me because I just feel better, right? At the end of the day. However, yesterday, and the reason I bring this up because you've talked about this large animal kind of feed animal lifestyle, how maybe there's some potential benefits if you're a veterinarian that might be a better career path as far as overall health and well-being. The reason I bring that up is like yesterday I was driving back from the bank and I'm up in Evergreen and I watched this expedition slam this deer at like 50 miles an hour. And I'm like maybe 200 or 300 yards away. I'm like 3 or 4 cars behind. So I see it from the distance. And at first I just see this animal fly through the air that's a decent size. And I think somebody's dog just got hit. That was the first thing in my mind. Then I realize it's a deer. But as I drive, like other cars had stopped. So at this point, there's no point in me stopping. So I'm going around, getting around it. And it has burned into my memory for the last like 24 hours. This deer, like lifting her head in complete agony, like just absolute agony. And, you know, somebody who loves endurance sports, like there's been those times, mm-hmm. like say I have wrecked on my mountain bike where you're just in like, this happened to me the other day. I wrecked, but it was like so painful. And you're trying everything you can do just to be okay with it and to be okay with the pain. And you're just like trying to breathe through it. But your entire existence in that moment is just pain and agony. And I couldn't imagine what this deer was going through. And ironically, in what went through my mind is I was like, if there's anything that made me not want to eat another animal again, is as if I already don't, you know, I already don't, is watching this animal on its deathbed in complete agony. Now, I know we have all these things around, like, trying to kill the animals humanely and stuff. And again, to do some sort of vegan propaganda, and again, it's not propaganda, but you know, I listened to this story of this guy who was a prisoner, you know, 6'4", 250 pounds, had killed multiple people, right? And he's in jail for life. And he got put on like work detail at a slaughterhouse. And his job was to essentially shock these cattle to death, right, with this like massive cattle, like it was like this massive like bolt of lightning that basically just like went through these cattle. And he tells the story of how he didn't think it would be anything, and he walks up and this cow is looking at him, and he's like, I swear to God, she was crying because she knew what was about to happen. And he's like, I couldn't do it. And he like, at that point, he never just, you know, he was like, I'm never going to eat animals again. So it's interesting. And I would love your perspective, like being involved with animals that are eventually going to be like, that become feed, like what's that like? Again, not to say I just want to know the other side of it.
I'll go on the record first as a total blood sucking carnivore. But it is not, I don't, trying to say this in the best possible way. I hear your perspective and I understand your perspective, and where you're coming from is a place of caring and empathy. But I would have to say that farmers and caretakers and producers of these animals that become our food are some of the most caring, hardworking, empathetic people on earth. I think our food animal veterinarians and our regulatory veterinarians who are out here working on this are some of the most caring and hardworking people on earth. And I think every one of them, every step along the way, is really dedicated to having those animals thrive. If those animals are living in stressed conditions, they are not going to become what anybody wants them to become. Temple Grandin has dedicated her career and done so much research to put into making going into an abattoir the most humane experience
that it could possibly be. What is that?
I think you called it a slaughterhouse.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, into a meat plant. So much research has gone into.
And I don't mean to interject, but is that the proper term? I've never heard before.
And I don't know how much has changed in 10 years, but yeah, going into a meat processing plant.
Plant, right, yeah.
She has done all this research and put in all these reforms so that cattle or hogs or chickens or whoever's going in there is as least stressed as they can be. She's even gone to the point of, like, you know, crawling in on her knees to see what they see and see what might be frightening and see what might be distressing. And all these places that are doing it above the board should be using the USDA approved methods of humane slaughter, whereby these animals are not essentially conscious when they pass away. So having been involved in it on that point, I would be one of the people who would have told you that going to a meat processing plant as a veterinary student really opened my eyes to how much care really does go in to making that not stressful and not a terrible experience for those animals.
Yeah, so elaborate. Like, and I think it's fascinating because you don't really ever hear the story. And again, like, and I'm not trying to stand in a soapbox because really, like, at the end of the day, I don't care how you eat.
Right.
I mean, I guess I do in some regards. Like, people that are eating, like, the window diet, you know, where you basically drive up, you grab whatever is out of the window, it's not good. You know, if you're eating out of a box, it's not good. You know, But it's not my job to tell you how you eat. I would hope for some of those people that are eating out of a bag or eating out of a box primarily their lives, they would make some form of change. Even if that is, you know, if that involves a lot more animal products, but at least they're making real food, right?
Right.
So that's really the only stance that I care about how people eat.
I think a lot of people come at it from an environmental bent as well. But I think there are some really great research-based innovations coming out about rotational grazing, coming out about using the land really well in such a way that cattle are actually replenishing what's supposed to be in the soil and making it more arable for the future, using land that's not arable for plant-based crops, and trying to use that in a way that's more efficient. So not only would I encourage you to kind of check out all of Temple Grandin's work on how things can be done really well and really humanely for these animals, but also some of the research that went into Rob Wolf's book, Sacred Cow. So Rob Wolf, R-O-B-B, Wolf, W-O-L-F. And I haven't read the whole book yet, but he really dives into the perspective that if you're using rotational grazing and you're using land that's not arable for human crops, that it can actually be a really efficient way to heal the environment in some respects while providing food. So I think this is really one of those areas where it's possible in the United States, where things are really polarized, to choose to read only things that support your own point of view.
No, you're 100% right.
So I just want to throw you some resources that might not cross your path.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I'm totally, I don't come at it, and I didn't come from the plant-based diet as a humanitarian, if I'm 100% honest. I've had, like, this deer thing yesterday, it was just
upsetting, no matter who you are.
I mean, but it was one of those moments that just re-emphasized me, and it made me think about it. And it, again, because it's my own lens. I'm looking at, again, this is my own life experience, my own lens. But I came to a plant-based diet, and I don't even like to use the V word, right? Like vegan, because it is so politically charged, right? If I say that, then somebody thinks that, like, I'm the one that's trying to film these, you know, these animal factories or whatever the PC term is, or slaughterhouse, whatever you want to call it. But that wasn't me. It was just I was training for a big bike race. It was 120 miles and over three mountain passes. And I found that the fewer animal products I consumed, the better I felt, the harder I could train. And I was, as a result, I rode the race in like 8 hours and 15 minutes or something. And I felt 100% fine mm-hmm. afterwards. I wasn't tired. I wasn't sleepy. I wasn't like, oh, I need, you know, like some people run their
you
first marathon.
Wiped.
Yeah. Like my body hurts. I felt fine. I could have went to my nephew's birthday party afterwards
right.
And been totally fine. Yeah. So that was my approach. So I guess it never for me was an animal rights thing, but being involved in the community and being involved with certain people, like there's people like this, I'll throw his name out there because he's a big, you know, YouTuber, social media guy, but his name's Earthling Ed, and he goes on his whole shtick is compassion for animals, and we talk about the atrocities of factory farming, and like, again, to bring in somebody else earlier, like Joe Rogan, who is like the king of podcasting, and he's talked to all walks of life people on both sides, right? And he even had this debate between somebody who felt that animal diets are far better than plant-based diet, and they were allowed to kind of debate on a show, which was super fascinating. But we never really, like, you know, you talk about this idea of the humane death and almost like kosher foods, right? Like, I think mm-hmm. that was part of Jewish culture, is this idea that the animal has, if it's going to give up its life for you, there's rules and regulations on how that has to occur. And if somebody's Orthodox Jewish out there and I'm wrong, you can correct me, I'm making assumptions. But I do think it is fascinating too. So I guess I'm just, with that massive long-winded explanation, I guess I'm saying I am not turned off to the idea of listening to other people's opinions.
Right.
But I do 100% agree with you that what diet has become, in a lot of respects, religion, right? Like
it's true.
It becomes your identity.
That's
and
the whole orthorexia is its own new eating disorder classification of, I have to get my diet 100% right 100% of the time. Yeah. But I think what you're speaking to is that there's more than one way to go about things, and that we shouldn't be so polarized.
Yes.
So you found that a plant-based diet has worked really, really well for you in terms of getting you through these endurance races, improving your health. And I come at things from a primal health coaching lens. It's part of what I do in Agents of Change. And so I could also tell you that eating a primal diet, which is very highly based in fresh fruits and vegetables, more vegetables than fruits, a lower carb paradigm with, you know, the bulk of your plate is taken up by vegetables, but the bulk of your calories comes from animal proteins. And on that plan that's completely opposite from yours, I also have lost 92 pounds, gotten my first ever cholesterol readings that were in the normal range.
That's
because
awesome.
I'm
yeah.
genetically predisposed to have my heart burst into flames in the next 5 years. And also started getting a lot of personal records on my own endurance races as well. So I think this really speaks to the fact that there's what you said, the window diet mm-hmm. being not very healthy, but that there's more than one way to approach good health. There's
yep.
more than one way to approach being a good steward of our environment. There's more than one way to approach being humane to animals.
Yes.
And none of them are wrong.
Yeah, right. No, you're 100% right. And I think it makes me think of this story of these two. Again, this podcast wasn't supposed to be about diet and being a politically charged vegan or something like that. But I think that's what I love about this is that it makes me think of the story of these two Irish guys who are, they're big into the plant-based diet, and they've written all these cookbooks and how, you know, it could have a overall impact on your health. Again, I think it comes back to, I think if we simplify it, like with the diet that you kind of explained, this like kind of more primal eating, again, it comes back to the idea that you're eating whole foods, right?
Right.
And that's why I like to use the term plant-based, because if I just say vegan, like, I love chips. I love French fries and potato chips.
But you cannot subsist on Tostitos alone.
No, exactly. And my diet would be terrible.
Right.
But I would be vegan, right? Like,
right.
because I was just
Oreos and Fritos are both vegan.
Yes, exactly. But I wouldn't be healthy. But I think it comes back to this idea of, like, eating real food, right? And the impact that can have on your life. And But yeah, these two guys, I guess where I was going with that is, you know, they had come out and they're like, well, how do you manage your diet? And they're like, well, we're pretty flexible with it. And like, I am pretty flexible with it as well. Like sometimes like my mother and father-in-law want to have pizza. So do I eat the cheese? Yes, I eat the cheese, whatever. You know, like I loved cheese, whatever. Do I cook with cheese or if I'm making my own meals, do I cook with it? No, I don't. I don't use any carbs.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. It doesn't mean you can never have a window meal when it's been 10 hours since you ate.
Exactly,
yes. But it means you got to get back on track.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like 80-20, right? And it's this idea of balance. But these two guys were like, I mean, they were butchered by the community. I mean, like if you really are passionate about this animal rights thing, what by crucifying two guys who are also on your team,
who like, benefits from that?
Nobody does. Exactly. Yeah. Nobody benefits, which is, yeah. Anyways, we got on this, tangent.
With two sets of hands, bring back the ability for people who do things differently to talk to each other.
Exactly. Right. No, I think you're right. I mean, we have really lost the idea as a community and culture. And I think 2020 has been a crazy year, but I think it has brought that about even more, right? Like we're not allowed to talk to people who disagree with us, and
we haven't started punching each other yet.
No.
And I'm not planning on it.
Exactly, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, because and I think that's the amazing thing is that like for me, like say you're having a barbecue, I wouldn't be like, well, I can't come over because it's going to be primarily meat based. Maybe I would bring something else, or maybe I would just enjoy a salad and some chips. And have fun with everybody, right? Like, but that's the lost that. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And man, I just got on my own my own personal soapbox. But I am really interested in this idea of what it's like working with large animals. And you talked about this idea of health and overall life. So why didn't you go back to that?
So I couldn't be, you know, 2 hours away from here in a rural place and my software developer husband still actually work. So that's kind of how that compromise came about. And now I'm fairly rooted here. So I'm here on the west side of Denver. My kids are in school here, you know, all those kind of things. So, yeah. And as you've seen from hearing most of my resume, what's my longevity in one topic?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've kind of been all over the place in the course of the last 40 minutes.
So. Yeah. No, you're right. Woods is great.
So
yeah.
What I really need is 3 lifetimes to get done everything that I'm interested in.
Yeah. Okay. So how have you managed that? How do you manage the pivot?
Oh, not very well right now. I'll be completely vulnerable and transparent about that. Man, I am loving everything that I'm doing, but I am working too much, and I, like probably many people in the United States, it's not exactly financially possible for me to just leap entirely, and so both with the coaching business and with the at-home euthanasia service, I need to ease in and allow those to build slowly while I phase out slowly of doing relief work over time. And so right now I've kind of ended up with 4 jobs in the short term. And especially with so many people out of work and the economy in the tank right now, I'm hesitant to let go of any of those. I do enjoy all of them. I do care about all of them. But I really found myself paying attention the other day to somebody who said, can you use my work email for work and my home email for home? And I thought, oh my God, that's so important because right now I have 5 email addresses, a personal one and one for each of my 4 jobs.
Yeah.
And somebody was like, well, how do you manage that? And I said, well, not very well. So, yeah. So I opened, you know, Peace Wings Home Euthanasia in April, and I printed business cards with the website on them with the domain name that I bought for the website, and I've yet to find the time to set up the website. And so now I'm starting to get little messages that have said, you know, we tried to go to your website and somebody's squatting there, nobody's really using this domain. And yeah. I'm like, well, you know, I'll get to it when I can, but in the shorter term, I've chosen to spend the time that I had and go to people's houses and help their pets. So, man, I just wish there was more time. I wish I was more efficient. I wish things would get flying more quickly so that I could be more focused. But on the other hand, I like the variety too. So
yeah,
that's how it's going.
So basically what you're saying is you pivot and you just kind of look and you just kind of deal with it day to day.
Day to day. And it's hard to, on some level, it's hard to arrange those schedules because I get scheduled for a relief shift 4 months out, but I'm talking to most people who need an at-home euthanasia 2 days out.
Which that's a great question, because you know, as I was thinking to myself, you know, as I was telling my own story, and I said, you know, next time, you know, with Atreyu, when it's time for him to go,
you named him Atreyu. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
The Neverending Story is the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater.
Really?
Have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
I'm derailing you again.
No, it's okay. That's what this is about.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So I went back in my 20s and read all the books that my favorite children's movies were based on.
Ah.
Because I'm the opposite. I like to see the movie first and then go read the book because the book fills in the gaps. And I feel like I'm being a nosy neighbor and learning all this gossip about characters that I'm already friends with.
Right.
So you should go back and read The Neverending Story. It's actually an amazing book.
Oh, I'm going to have to do that. Yeah, and that's where his name came from.
Yeah.
Ironically, there's, you know, I was in a band, and there was a band called Atreyu, and everybody's like, oh, did you name him after the band? And I'm like, no, I do like the band, but no.
I named him after the...
Yeah, after the movie. And we had Atreyu and Sebastian.
Awesome.
So we had two Yorkies. They were about 6 months apart. And then, but unfortunately, Sebastian was born with a bad heart, and he lasted like 22 days before he didn't make it. So anyways, yeah, and then we ended up getting Cash, and... You know, with Yorkies, like when they're puppies, you can kind of peel the hair back and you can see if the silver's coming through. But with Cash, it was like, you know, this is as Brené Brown says, being very vulnerable, right? And so I don't know how many of my veterinary friends out there are now going to super judge me and not want to be friends with me anymore. But both of our dogs came from the pet store.
I forgive you.
Okay, thank you.
It's okay.
I mean, again, this was 15 years ago. I didn't know. But anyway, so like that, yeah, the pet store said he was just a Yorkie, but he had this really thick, kind of curly hair too.
Yeah.
Which I don't ever really see with Yorkies. You know, like Atreyu is classic Yorkie, ribbon candy color hair, super straight, thin, you know. But Cash had this really thick hair. Anyways, with that, we could see that he wasn't going to turn silver. He was going to stay all black and pretty much tan. So we named him Cash after Johnny Cash.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's where that came about. And now I completely, totally lost where we were going with that because we were talking. Oh, yeah. But the idea of, you know, if I was going to do it again, I would call somebody, you know, like I would call your kind of service and have somebody come to the house. But how much notice do you need, right? Like, because in that moment, I would have been like, he's super sick. There's no way he may even make it through the night.
It depends. Different individuals, different disease processes, different pets. It's different all the time. Because I'm the only person at my business, I kind of tell people up front. I've turned away cases where I couldn't get there in time, where I felt a pet was really suffering. I'd rather they get what they need if it doesn't come from me. Anybody who's doing a good job would say that. There are larger at-home euthanasia services in our area who have a little more flexibility. They may be able to come sooner. And I also, part of when I'm talking with somebody about when we're going to schedule this and when I'm going to come and how much time we need to allow, is that I go through in every single one of those phone calls, what do you need to look for to tell if your pet's in distress? And if your pet's in distress, do you know where to go for ER? Because I can't necessarily leave my house all the time at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I make sure I arm them with the knowledge to know if they need something sooner, if they need care sooner, and where to get it.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's, you know, and then I guess, you know, also talking with our GP, it also sounds like he probably could have survived another couple of days before he was completely, what is it? What's the right word? Like septic? Is that where like the infection spreads through the...
Or just
blood.
Really out of it.
Yeah.
Just really not well.
Yeah, yeah. Which would have been terrible.
Yeah.
Anyways. But one thing that you've also mentioned, and I also can resonate because I made the decision at some point to go to law school and spend a lot of money to do so, this idea of student loans, you know, and it's something that honestly I can resonate with because law school wasn't cheap. And, you know, I'm now in that boat where it's like, I also have to pay for it. And you do feel trapped and you're like, oh, you know, what am I going to do to be able to repay that? And, am I ever going to be able to repay it? And there's this whole conversation around, you know, why does education cost so much? You know, there's a lot of questions around that. But as somebody who is an agent for change, how have you managed that now going forward? You know, I mean, do you just, like, for me, I'm just like, well, I'm going to figure it out, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. Like with this new business venture is like, well, I'll just figure it out, you know? How have you managed that?
I have not managed to make or effect any change on the federal system of student loans, but it's also not my target.
Right.
So,
Well, I guess my question is, because you said at one point you felt trapped, like you couldn't do anything else, but yet you have seen, but it does in your story, you have talked a lot about a change and you've been able to change and kind of almost release that pressure of feeling like you're trapped.
That's true. It took me a while to think of it. It took me a while to find the way out. And, you know, a lot of that answer came from listening to the people who came to the veterinary support group, listening to the people I was coaching, and looking around and seeing where there really is a need to change veterinary culture and where I could insert myself. Because, and this circles around to the idea of people who come to veterinary medicine as though it's a calling. That's my target. That's the piece of our culture that I really want to change. So I think for me, it's always important to feel like I have some agency. I have some choice in things, not to feel trapped. And once I really identified that here was something I want to change, then I had an avenue to go down where I thought I might be able to reasonably make a living. I think I can help. I think this will be meaningful to me and is going to improve the world that I'm trying to leave instead of just walking away from it and letting it go down in flames.
So what is you mentioned, like, you have this, like, calling or this passion or whatever, although if
what I want to do is give all veterinarians and technicians and veterinary workers the permission to not view veterinary medicine as a calling, to view it as just a job. And that is a loaded thing to say, because people, again, when we're going to talk about all the things that are wrong with our culture in the United States, people really want to vomit a little bit when they hear the words just a job.
Yeah.
Because right now, there's all those sayings out there. You know, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. But there are, you know, we've got the Merck Veterinary Wellbeing Study. We've got the rates of suicide and substance use on the parts of veterinarians and veterinary professionals to prove that this all isn't working. And I really believe that veterinarians can be good at what they do, find meaning in their work, be profitable, excel at it, show people that they care, and still have it be just a job, and still be able to go home and disengage from their work and be with their kids or be with the book in the bathtub, or be on a long run, or whatever it is that makes them come alive when they're outside of work. You can still care and have meaning and do all that stuff. There are 40 to 50 years worth of research out there that say that having meaning at work is important, but when you take it, you know, it's important for satisfaction and performance and, you know, longevity in your career and for your personal well-being. But when you take it too far and bring it to the point where you're looking at your work as a calling, you lose sight of everything else. That's what a calling is. You know, the idea of having a calling comes from the world's religions, where someone is called to the priesthood or called to be a rabbi or called to be a religious leader. And the idea of having a calling implies a vow of poverty. In some of those religions, it implies a vow of celibacy, and ain't nobody here signed up for anything like that, right? So, you know, that's what our veterinarians are running into. And I think that if you're viewing veterinary medicine as a calling, we're only in the early stages of getting some research about what happens. What's the dark side of having a calling? We know that having meaning at work brings you engagement and satisfaction and better performance and better business outcomes. But when you go too far and take it to being a calling, you start to get a population of people that are prone to workaholism, perfectionism, burnout, other mental health issues, and here's the kicker, employer exploitation. Because why, if you care so much about what you're doing, if this is a calling for you, why should you be expected to stay late to see this extra case if it means so much to you? And that's not fair. That's what's destroying the lives of veterinarians. That's what's driving everybody to suicide and substance use disorder and all these other terrible things that are happening to all of us. And so I think if we can break the taboo around the idea that something's just a job, but you can still care about it and do good at it and have meaning there, then we're going to give veterinarians and technicians and veterinary workers a boundary where they can say, you know what? Physicians get to close their doors. Even our EMTs and our firefighters get to go home from work and not be on call. We've got to set this up in a way where I get compensated and I can pay my student loans. We've got to set this up in a way where I'm able to know that what I'm doing is worth something and ask to be treated appropriately by my employer. And that includes being able to go home at the end of your shift and re-engage with your family. It breaks my heart when I read stories online and in online groups with veterinarians and in circles where I'm sitting face to face with veterinarians where they're just like, I worked 50 hours over 4 days, spent 3 hours, 5 hours writing my notes outside of that, and I finally had to have a day off, and I had to get my mother-in-law to come take care of my kids because I was so unable to function that I couldn't engage with my own family. How's that going to lead to a healthy, long life with good relationships where you want to stay in this career? So that's kind of my target there.
What about those people who they do feel it is their calling?
There's nothing wrong with that. But circling back around to Brené Brown, there's nothing wrong with that if that's right for somebody. But I think it's not right for everybody. And I am angry about all the shame that I see making people sick and feel awful to the point of suicide and substance abuse and total mental illness if they feel they're supposed to have a calling and they don't.
Do you follow Seth Godin at all?
He's
a big marketer now. He built the company and then ended up selling it to Yahoo for, a couple digits worth of millions, and then became like their vice president. And he writes a lot of books and everything. But anyways, are you familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk? Okay. It's funny because they're friends, but they're kind of like they have opposite viewpoints and opinions. But anyways, Seth Godin, he makes this statement that he thinks the idea that you have to find your passion in your job is a joke. And he's like, you can find ways to find the things that drive like passion and stuff in the work that you do. It doesn't necessarily have to be to use your term, like your calling, or it doesn't necessarily have to. But I also strongly kind of believe in this old Japanese concept called the ikigai, which is where you kind of look at these different things. Like you look at what are your passions in life? What are you good at? What will people pay you for? What does the world need? And then where is that kind of overlapping? Where do they overlap? And then that's kind of your purpose in life.
And your sweet spot.
Yeah, yeah. Your sweet spot. Yeah, I think that's another good thing. But I can also really resonate with that. Like you're talking about this whole on-call thing, and the technology profession is the same in a lot of ways, in that because our entire lives are run digitally, now we have, it's the lifeblood of our business. We have like this idea that technology has to, we need 99.9% uptime and we have to do all this stuff. And so it's like, oh, but we want to have good work-life balance, but you're constantly on call. And if something happens, you're going to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week until everything's fixed. And so there's a lot of the same problems in the same industries. I haven't heard a lot that there's a lot of the same kind of problems in the tech space, but from a leadership standpoint, in a previous role, it was one of those things where it was like, how do we figure out to not do that, right? how do we figure it out where our technician, we had this network admin who, the guy would just work, you know, and it was like, he would keep working on it until it was up and, it, you know, but I knew that eventually it was going to burn him out. And so how do we not get to that point, I think, is in, how do we structure business and how do we structure our lives so that we don't get to that point where we run people into the ground?
Or ourselves.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's an interesting piece of this calling thing, because when I first started thinking about it deeply and talking about it deeply with people I was close to, I had one friend who said, isn't this just a boundary problem? Isn't it just that we're not taught how to have boundaries and veterinarians just need to have better boundaries and then it'll all be fine. They'll be able to leave work at the end of the day. And I think in our wider culture at large, but also especially in the veterinary world, there's this litmus test where we almost get hazed when we're coming through school. I'll tell you three disturbing stories from my own veterinary school. I had one friend and classmate who died during our senior year because he came back to school too soon when he had the swine flu. And he did that because he'd had a couple of sick days earlier in the year, and they had all these things of like, yeah, technically you can take a sick day, but we don't really encourage it. That's letting down your other classmates. That's letting down your patients. That's letting down your clients. That's showing that you don't care. And so we've got this policy where if you're sick more than 3 days on a given rotation, you flunk that rotation. And if you flunk more than three rotations, instead of just finishing up and doing a couple extra rotations at the end of the year to finish out your year and walking with the class in December or whatever other places do, we're going to make you repeat the whole year to the tune of another $40,000 in student loans. And so he had had sick days throughout some of his other rotations. And then he went on to his large animal rotation and he went out in the field and he contracted the swine flu. And he got sick and he took a sick day, but he's like, if I don't go back to school, even if I feel horrible, I am going to flunk. You know, it's not his fault that he got sick. And he went back and he died due to complications from the swine flu. And they discovered after his death that he had a congenital heart defect, something he was born with that had never been detected, that made his immune system just a little weaker. And that's why he had been sick so much. But he literally died trying to become a veterinarian. And we have all these things in place. You know, I had another mentor on one of my rotations who had missed the birth of his second child because the professor teaching him wouldn't let a classmate cover for him on his treatments in the surgery ward to go see his wife in labor. It's not like he didn't find somebody to take his spot. It's not that that patient didn't receive care. He had three classmates who were willing to say, let me take that for you tonight. You take it for me 3 nights from now. We'll swap out. We'll make sure the patients are covered. But they were, it's hazing. It's hazing to say you can't go to the hospital and still pass this rotation and see your kid be born. And so I think veterinarians and veterinary technicians are systematically taught that they can't have boundaries. And I wrote in my exit interview when I left veterinary school, they had us fill out this exit interview saying, well, what did you think about your vet school experience? And I got a good education and I was prepared when I went out and I had some of those things to say. But I will tell you, after seeing what some of my classmates went through, my first sentence was, I am really angry that you thought I had to be hazed in order to prove that I wanted to be there. And it's people who were shamed when they come through vet school, then shaming the people that came behind them and saying, if you don't jump through this hoop and that hoop, I don't think you care enough. I don't think you care enough. I don't think you care enough. And so we compromise our needs. We don't go to the bathroom. We don't take a sick day. We don't, you know, go to our sister's wedding. You know, it's a death by a thousand cuts where we're taught over and over again, you're not allowed to have these boundaries. And this is why it's so important to give people permission to not describe this as their calling, because that shame propagation continues. Why didn't you trade shifts with so-and-so? Well, I've had this vacation scheduled for a year. Never mind that being able to use the vacation that's part of my work benefits is an important mental health safeguard for me. Like, you know, being shamed into, well, you have to trade shifts back, or you can't take that week even if you bought your plane ticket 6 weeks in advance. All these kind of things. The idea that this can be just a job in itself is a boundary. It's a way to say, you know what, veterinary medicine is very important to me, and my clients and my patients are very important to me, but so are my kids. And so is my mom, and so is my mental health and my physical health. And that's okay. And that is as it should be.
Yeah.
So, big deal.
No, it is. And I think it's, and I think part of it is just the overall, I'm not one of those people who, to paint me in somewhat of a political box, I'm not one of those people that thinks the entire capitalistic structure is terrible, right? I think that there are some great things, and there are great mm-hmm. opportunities for people that really want to do things. And there's been great people, stories of immigrants who have moved here and built lives that they never mm-hmm. could have dreamed of off of doing things that they really enjoy. And I mean, you can make money doing the darndest things, right? Like, back to the diet thing, there's this doctor who, he writes this book called The Plant Paradox, and I'm sorry, it is a joke. If you follow any sort of nutritional research, it is an absolute joke. And the guy, but he, I'll give him credit, he's an MD, but he makes a crap ton of money selling these bullshit books. I'm sorry. I'm just, like, just one of those things where I'm like, it just amazes me sometimes. Because, you know, I had this conversation with my buddy Josh the other day, and we were talking about, you know, like, how to have the right values and how to really stand behind your why and why mm-hmm. you want to do things. And, you know, my personal why is that most vets didn't know I have, A, they don't think they have any data that's valuable. And so in that, they A, don't think that they're a target of attack, and then B, they basically leave the door open for almost anybody and anybody to take advantage of them and the data that they have. And yeah, so my soapbox is, you know, my why is like, if there's one thing I can do, and that's change the opinion of the private practice owner to understand that they do have data that's valuable mm-hmm. and there are ways to protect themselves, regardless if they work with me or not, then I've done my job, right? But I think there is this ancillary effect in Western culture, which it just seems that it's this idea that, again, back to Seth Godin, you know, he says the hustle is bullshit, in that, you know, it's like, well, if I just keep hustling, that it's going, you know, things are going to get better. It's like, no, I think that, to take his point, there are ways to structure things and ways to do things to where...
To work smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Exactly. Exactly.
I want to thank you so much for waiting for me all this time.
No, it was my time. I was way early.
For coming here and spending so much time talking with me. It's really cool to get to know you more.
Yeah, likewise. Well, we are a little bit over the hour. So this is your soapbox. This is where you get to tell your story. Where can people find you? Where can they find out more about you?
So
shameless,
I would love
self-promotion.
For you to track me down if you feel like you're stuck and you're not living in alignment, if you feel like you want to increase your health, if you feel like you want to discuss ways to have better boundaries, if you want your team to be more functional, if you want to work on creating peace in your life, if you just want something different than what you have, find me at Agents of Change Coaching. That website is working.
Awesome. That one's actually
So that's just agents, plural, AGENTS, of changecoaching.com. If you want home euthanasia services, call me at Peace Wings. I don't have a website yet, even though it's on the business card. But you can email me at peacewings@ourgoodgoodbye.com. And I use...
But that's... You have to be in Denver Metro, though.
Well,
or no, can you do...
I'll go... Until I'm too busy, I'm going a little further. I've been to Blackhawk, Lafayette, Castle Rock, as long as I can still...
But still within
it.
The four
Denver,
walls of Colorado.
Yeah, true. In the Denver Metro area. But I can coach online. That part's easy. And I actually am using the same phone number for both of them. Okay. So I'll give it to you now. It's 720-347-9613.
Awesome. Well, I feel like there's still so much more we could talk about. And we could press we could press a lot of buttons.
But I really enjoyed talking to you, even though we come from very different corners.
Yes.
Because I want to have those kind of conversations with everybody.
Right. Me too. That's the point, right? People of veterinary medicine. Yeah. It's awesome. It's amazing. Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cool. I wrote down Seth Godin.